We are going to talk about death this hour. How to die wisely. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest will be leading workshops on death and dying in Wisconsin next week. He is a former international consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations, and he is the author of the book Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. And we will welcome your questions and your own experiences. Do you think that we as a society need to change the way we talk about or treat death and the dying? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Stephen Jenkinson is an activist, teacher, author, and farmer who has worked extensively with dying people and their families. He is a former program director in a major Canadian hospital and a former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school. As mentioned, he has been an international consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations, educator and advocate in the helping professions, and he is the author of Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. Good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
We will talk about your workshops that you'll be holding in Wisconsin next week throughout the program. But first, what does it mean to die wise?
It means that you have a lifetime to prepare for such a project. I didn't call the book Die Wisely. Here's why. That refers to your dying time specifically, right? Wisely. But if I say die wise, it means, pardon me, it means that you have to bring the wisdom of a lived lifetime to bear on the time of dying. You don't wait, in other words. And, I was probably worked with 7, 8, 9, perhaps even 1,000 people who died. And during that time, it was very clear that most of them waited. They waited to learn about dying. They waited to care about it. They waited to get as far away from it as they could. And all of that waiting has had the probably unintended consequence of, I would say, 90% of those deaths being, by any sense of the kind of sane sense of the term, they were bad deaths. And largely that was because of a belief that somehow coming to your dying required a terminal diagnosis to do so.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody seemed to wait for.
Yeah, why do you think so many of us wait?
Well, it's peculiar, a parallel you could draw is if you had a chance to get ready to be a parent, a real chance, do you think, would you wait until you were delivered your child to come to any thought about it or any, would you wait until the child's born to start thinking of names or why you're having a kid or what you would hope or dream for that child? I don't think so. I don't think anybody does that.
No, but we're afraid of death, aren't we?
On the other end of life, of course. That's the way it goes. And the idea would be that the further you stay away from it, the more life-affirming you are.
Yeah.
And that's madness, because dying is as fundamental a part of life as any other part of life is fundamental than many others. And it has an enormous part to play in determining your humanity and your personhood all the way through your days.
So how do we get ready for death when we're hosting radio shows and having a good time?
Well, maybe we're going to modify that phrase about getting ready, because the implication of the phrase is that somehow if you do the right thing, it's going to be smooth sailing or you'll know what you're doing. Well, the truth is, of course, it's an unprecedented thing, is it not? The phrase I used earlier was learning about it, which is a little different tone. So how do you learn about it? The answer is every death in your life before your own is your chance to get a PhD in the way it is. There's no question about it. And You know, you and I can talk about it, and hopefully people will listen. And what you hope is they're prompted in this direction. But the actual preparedness, the actual deep learning, this comes from being there. And I don't think there's a surrogate for that. So how many times was I asked by a well-intended parent whether they should bring, you know, their four-year-old to see Grandpa in the hospital or in the funeral home? And every time I would ask, but why wouldn't you? In other words, why does the focus fall on why would you? And doing so has to be somehow defended. And the default situation, the default, you know, good parenting is you keep your kids as far away from, you know, the big stories of life as you can until what? Until what's the magic age or the magic moment? So you actually realize that we learn about this aversion at a very early age by virtue of being excluded from these things generally.
Yes.
And that's an enormous part of the answer as to what's to be done is kids deserve to get in on this as much as they deserve to get in on learning, you know, where babies come from and other deep realities of being a human being.
Right. So we get ready, using the wrong phrase, by learning and starting that learning early.
Yes, and it's, you know, first of all, it's exposure. We're not talking about a kind of formal, you know, education per se. Not really. Just an exposure. Most of us come to dying as amateurs, right? I mean,
yeah. We've never done it before.
Never mind personally, but mm-hmm. but there's so many shields, right? It's been such a professionalized ghetto over the last 20 or 30 years. We have this silo called, you know, palliative care, the idea being that somehow this would be a sign that we're sort of coming around as a culture, you know, that we have such a thing. I think it's as much an indication that we have a high regard for dying and a desire to learn it as the proliferation of old folks' homes are somehow an indication that we have a high regard for age.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what is the downside, the harm in not learning about or talking about death until it is thrust upon us.
The principal consequence is going to sound benign to you probably at first. You spend your entire dying time, and let me begin by saying there is such a thing as your dying time, just like there's such a thing as your adolescence. It's not a point of view. There really is such a thing. And so you come to that time, and the entire time that you're in it, you spend it not doing it. In other words, the way I crafted them to describe with a kind of default etiquette that seems to surround dying is that you spend your dying time not dying. So at some level, of course, metabolically, you know, in the sheer medical sense of the term, yes, you're approaching your death, yes. But in terms of how you live, what people said to me all the time is, I understand I'm seriously ill, but I don't let it be a big part of my life. That's exactly what it sounds like when you're not doing it.
Yeah, it makes me think of someone I knew who died last year, mm-hmm. who spent the time before she died never wanting to talk about it, wanting to be positive. She was going to fight this thing. She was going to live, and she didn't. And it became it was just very hard. There was no there wasn't really living going on there either.
I can hear by the change in your voice as you're telling that what it was like, mm-hmm. and it's you know, it's that's the bad death I've described to you earlier. It's they're small, they're inward turned, they're private, they're kind of in their way absolutist about what kind of people and what kind of conversations are allowed anywhere close. I mean, this is not a good recipe for any of us learning anything except that it's never good for you, that it can never be anything meaningful. It's just a matter of how you control how bad it gets. What kind of, I mean, that learning is that predisposes most people to an orientation of control, right? And now, the enormous energy that's gathering around discussions about euthanasia all over North America now. A lot of these are informed by an entire lack of experience in these matters and a kind of almost maniacal insistence on personal control and choice, as if your whole life has been characterized by immense amounts of personal control, and now you come to your dying time where your body more or less relinquishes any possibility of being as it once was, and the idea that you're in control of this is a fantasy. But it's a fantasy that has a very powerful hold over the imagination, and suddenly euthanasia looks like a good solution to dying.
Let me jump in because we do have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will talk more about how to die wise. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Stephen Jenkinson. He is author of Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. And he will be leading workshops on death and dying when he visits Wisconsin next week. He will be holding a workshop on Wednesday, July 29th in Rhinelander, from 7 until 9:30 p.m. at the Art Start Cultural Center. And he will be holding a workshop on Thursday, July 30th in Madison at the First Unitarian Society at 6:30 p.m. And we'll put that information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. If you have a question for him or an experience you'd like to share about death or how we approach death, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Stephen, what do you do during these events?
You mean, what do I teach?
Yes.
Well, I teach... I suppose the principal thrust of the thing is that dying well is not like a lifestyle option, you know, one amongst many. That's the way it's usually presented, and I've seen the consequences of people coming to it either casually or not at all. So I suppose I teach the mandate of dying wise as part of being a human being, part of being a social human being, and something like a kind of moral obligation, a political obligation, and a spiritual obligation that we actually have to each other as much as, you know, quote, to ourselves.
Yeah. Before our news break, you were talking about the trend or the... I guess the fact that there is people who are talking about euthanasia. They don't want to. They don't want a long, agonizing, suffering death.
Yeah.
Is that what we should do in terms of if instead of having a long death like that, decide when the time is right when we want to exit?
Yeah. I think I can tell you where the request for euthanasia usually appears, and it does not appear, in my experience, rarely in the time of agonies or, you know, writhing at 3 a.m. and that kind of thing. The request for it was always in the in-between time, the kind of middle range where people are generally asymptomatic and there's not much going on. The demand for euthanasia, as I saw it, is really a consequence of people not wanting to die at all. It's not a consequence of terrific pain and all of the rest. It's invoked at a time when, quote, this suffering is not really that pervasive at the time. In other words, what you begin to realize is people think that the fundamental suffering around dying comes from pain and symptoms and the drugs and the prolongation of it. Where the suffering actually comes from is informed by the fact that the dominant culture in North America is death-phobic to begin with, which means that the principal suffering of dying comes from knowing you are. And ironically, where most of the management and the discussion goes is to minimize how much we actually know about it. And the less you know about it, the less you're aware of it, the less suffering there is. That's where most of the thrust goes. As soon as it's impossible to ignore or to live otherwise, that's when the demands from euthanasia come. That's when you realize that our understanding about dying is contorted around this idea that knowing you're dying is the principal source of suffering. I give you a little example. I was teaching one time, and a room full of therapists asked me, basically, what gives you the right to be so direct with people who are dying, you know, in conversation? From this objection, amongst people who work in the mental health field, you realize that even there, the idea is the more you know about it, the worse it gets. And my response to them was to say, well, what gives you the right to be so indirect with people who are dying? In other words, why is under-functioning, under-speaking, misrepresenting in our language around dying, why is that somehow the default courtesy or the default compassion? And being direct and clear and candid is somehow discourteous or malpractice or unnecessarily harsh.
A listener on Facebook shared the obituary of a Madison woman who killed herself earlier this year. Mm-hmm. She wrote her own obituary.
Yeah.
And she said, after years of contemplation, deliberation, and discussion, I decided to peacefully set sail for the next big adventure in the comfort of my home, sweet home. She was not necessarily terminally ill. She just decided that it was time to go, and she did cite in a letter that she, you know, she watched her parents die, I guess not a bad death, and she didn't want to do that.
Sure. Yeah, you're going to hear more and more and more of stories like this. And you know, I'll say it again. There are realities to dying. I'm not saying for a second they're all pleasant or wonderful, quote, experiences. You know the famous bumper sticker, oh, no, not another life experience. So these aren't, we're not talking about something that's full of wonder necessarily. I am realistically talking about something that, strangely enough, everyone deserves. There was a film came out a few years ago, Bucket List, it was called.
Yes.
Everybody seems to know about it, even if they haven't seen it. The idea being, you get a terminal diagnosis, and you turn into some kind of hero figure who's going to do all the things you didn't do when you were, quote, living. Well, I've been there. I've been there for years and years. I can tell you, first of all, that instinct is virtually not there to be suddenly heroic. But secondly, what kind of a script is this that we're writing for people who are dying, and now they have to super achieve on top of everything else? It's obscene in its way. And my view is the film should have been called something that rhymed with bucket lists. And yeah, oh, surely, because the obligation of dying people is not to suddenly not die heroically.
No.
The obligation of dying people is to undertake their dying with a kind of devotion, is the word I would use, a sense of deep, you know, responsibility and a capacity to imagine that their humanity is being crafted at this time. It's not being annihilated. When people say that dying is part of life, they generally don't mean it. They generally mean it's the absolute crushing of life. Yeah. But we don't say that about the first 9 months of life, that somehow it's not really living. But it's very similar. And if the story is told properly, you can't really distinguish the story of the very early part of your life and the very ending of your life. They have a lot of the same tones to them, to the point where people who are working in palliative care could best be understood as midwives, whose job is to get out of the way of what's happening and to enable what's happening, not to control it or contain it or turn it into something else.
So are you saying that suicide or even euthanasia is not dying wise?
Well, if you push me into a corner, I'd probably have to say that, yes, I would say that. Here's every bad death had what I described to you earlier. That degree of smallness, this kind of mania around controlling it, as if it belongs to you. Well, the truth of the matter is, if people exercise their, quote, right to end their lives when it suits them, one of the things they're not doing is living the consequences of exercising this right. And if you think about all the other rights of life, do they not include, you know, responsibilities? Do they not include knowing what the consequences to other people and other times will be for you doing what you're doing? Isn't this a kind of wisdom, actually, that we proceed in, knowing that decisions we make today will have considerable consequence, you know, generations from now? We're beginning to realize this ecologically, but when it comes to, you know, personal choices, somehow that wisdom is suspended, and it's all about you and your rights. Well, when people exercise what you, the quote right that you're asking me about, the consequences are legion, right? They ripple out like, you know, like a stone in a pond from that event. And the principal learning that vectors out to the general culture is that there's no merit in dying, that there's no good to be had from it. This is the actual learning that happens. It's no wonder then that when the language of euthanasia comes up, that, you know, the consequence in years will be that nobody has to die, that it's not an obligation, it's not part of life at all, it's some kind of rip-off situation, and you can do something about it. You don't even have to be there, kind of thing.
We are talking with Stephen Jenkinson. He is author of Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. We have many callers, so let me go to the phones. Cindy in Stevens Point is with us. Hello, Cindy.
Hello. I have worked in hospice for almost 11 years, and I would agree with what your guest is saying. There are people who kind of are in denial. You know, even some families will say, oh, don't mention hospice when you see my mom or dad, you know, who's a patient, like they don't know that they're dying, you know. And yet when you talk to them about things such as, you know, like if I want to ask if they want the sacrament of the sick, you know, oftentimes the, you know, the family member will say, oh, I don't think they're ready for it. I don't think you should, you know, do that. And I say, well, let me ask, you know, the patient. And they're just like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. You know I'm dying. And so, but then there are those, I think, who are more in denial and say, I'm going to fight this. And, you know, and they are the ones who I think don't die as peacefully as those who make their preparations, who say their goodbyes, mend their fences, those kind of things. And, you know, come to grips with it all.
Mm-hmm. Stephen?
Well, yes, obviously we're singing the same song, the two of us. I'd add to that in professional circles, and this is going to sound crazy, but I can tell you that in professional circles, one of the principles that get debated all the time is whether or not dying people have the right to die badly. And this is defended as a legitimate response to what dying is asking of you. And I think that amounts to debating whether or not people have a right to die at all. And maybe they have a right not to. But you know, sometimes you're speechless. You hear things, you can't quite believe your ears, that this has come down to a question of right. You know, but what's the obligatory part? Where's the rest of the story? The rest of the story is we learn about life from each other. And one of the obligations I think we have is to begin to teach each other through our example that dying is an absolutely legitimate consequence of being born. And it's a time that you enter into a kind of mystery that you begin to wonder about, not an endurance test that you get to opt out of.
Kurt, in an email, says, death is every day. We let go of bits of life every day. We die to our current situation. My father-in-law has been slowly dying over the last 5 years. Parts of him that we have known and love are gone forever, so we have been grieving our loss. He is still alive, and we are grateful to love him, but he has been dancing with death for several years. Maybe talk a little bit about the role of friends and family of the dying in dealing with their dying.
Well, if we're to be trustworthy companions for a period of time for someone who's dying, then it seems to me we have to risk the epic achievement of being a deep friend. And here's how I'd render what friendship really is, particularly at a time like that. Friendship is really not how people feel about each other, which even in the best friendships ebbs and flows. Friendship really is the willingness to risk the friendship itself for the sake of the person you claim as your friend. It can be a very risky proposition to be candid with someone who's dying. That's my way of saying that when dying people lose the scent, lose their way, lose their instinct about where they are, which can easily happen because they're surrounded by lunatic cheerleaders. That's my phrase for it. Then real friends, real companions will stay the course and help that dying person remember and revisit where in their life they are and what it asks of them, even if the dying person is not asking this of their friend.
Deborah emails, a line from a movie comes to mind. Get busy living or get busy dying. You can't convince me we should focus on the latter. She doesn't think we should get busy dying.
Well, she'll find out. That's what I can say about it. I've been there a million times. She'll find out. It's not really optional, number one. Number two, the statement carries a kind of apartheid that is completely uncalled for, that you either are living or you're dying, that somehow you can't do both at the same time. Well, you can hear the prejudices right there, that it somehow drives a wedge between your capacity to live and your capacity to feel, you know, sane. Let's put it this way. Our understanding of health now is basically the absence of disease. And so any dying person has no possibility of dying as a healthy dying person because of that mania. What I'm arguing for, what I'm pleading for, is the idea that if we change our understanding of health and we change our understanding of living to include this, not as an enemy, but as something that actually has the power, possibly, to invite you into a depth of living that your, quote, normal life couldn't even dream of. And that's basically what happens. Or that's what can happen, I should say. That's what's at stake. That we come to our dying time as kind of seekers, if you will. Unfortunately, in a death-phobic culture, the program is to seek ways of not having to die while you are. And that's a large part of, especially the medical aspects of palliative care. That's what they're there for.
We are going to once again check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll continue talking with our guest, Stephen Jenkinson, who is the author of Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Our guest has been an international consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations, educator and advocate in the helping professions, a former program director and assistant professor at a major Canadian hospital and medical school. He's going to be in Wisconsin next week leading some workshops on death and dying. And we are talking with him about how we should change the way we approach death, how we talk about death, how we treat death and the dying. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. Stephen Jenkinson is our guest. He is an activist, a teacher, an author. He will be leading teaching workshops on death and dying in Wisconsin next week. He will be in Rhinelander on Wednesday, July 29th. And he will be in Madison on Thursday, July 30th. And we will post information on those workshops on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. He says that our society really doesn't know how to handle death and dying. We should change how we approach death, how we die, how we care for dying people, how we prepare our children for dying. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Daryl in Couderay is with us. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Joy, and thank you, Professor Jenkins. I really appreciate your in-depth focus on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, too.
My question is, or comment, is that it seems we are taught to fear death. I believe mostly by doctors and the clergy. Of course, they profit from a person remaining living. So could our cultural mindset be predominantly formed in our society by those two entities? And it's interesting, for the clergy states over and over again that the spirit lives on. An interesting contradiction, it seems to me.
What do you say, Stephen Jenkinson?
I think that the doctors in particular are probably the easiest target for the cultural ambivalence around dying. And I'm not saying that there aren't certainly individual examples. I had, you know, terrible encounters with some doctors and, of course, remarkable encounters with some, too. I think certainly the things I'm pointing to are not driven by, invented by the medical communities or the devotional or religious communities. These dilemmas are culture-wide, and they're culturally endorsed. So to demonize a particular, you know, narrow aspect of the culture and imagine that they're somehow in on it in some kind of conspiracy, make sure that the real responsibility never appears. The reason the subtitle I gave to the book was A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. And the phrase manifesto implies some kind of politically charged understanding of what's at stake and perhaps what's to be done. I'm using that way of understanding it to plead with people to recognize that the principal responsibilities are to be acted on at a cultural level. I'm not just talking about legislation, but I'm certainly talking about things like the educational system, where generally kids are taught about the life cycle of frogs, and that's where it ends. And if you thought sex education was tough to get into schools, just try to get death education into the school. It's much more difficult, strangely enough, as if the dying thing is some kind of option that people have to consider, and they'll get to it when it suits them. There's the principal poverty of the time, I think, the idea that we defer to personal readiness, whether it's during the course of your life, whether you're inclined to, or when you finally get a terminal diagnosis or suspect something as serious is happening to your health. The people around you, yes, often including doctors and clergy and otherwise, will cut a wide swath around your inclinations as if that should come first, as if you know what's best for you. It's such a mysterious, strange and unnecessary and tragic kind of devotion that we actually wait for people to be ready to do something that almost no one wants to do. It makes you wonder when this readiness is actually supposed to magically kick in. And I'm saying, of course, that if we proceed knowing full well that this is part of our lives, then readiness is absolutely secondary.
So what other sorts of cultural policy changes might we make, for instance, with the healthcare system? What might a healthcare system look like that is helping us to die wise?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Well, first of all, it has to be a healthcare system. The dominant scenario in North America is a disease management system. Health means you're promoting health but you're also promoting a deep consideration of what constitutes health. And as I said earlier, take as a parallel our understanding of what it means to be a good person. Generally, that means the absence of being bad, right? As if by default, if you manage all your bad parts of yourself, you're going to be good. But in actual fact, the ability to be a good person derives from being a whole person. And whole means includes everything. By the same token, real health, fundamental health, or radical health includes all the challenges to health. You see? And when you end up with a disease management system, it demonizes everything that seems to compromise your ability to be healthy. I'm saying that our ability to be healthy derives in large measure from our encounters with sickness and limitation. That's where we learn that the life-affirming aspect of health includes what we think is not healthy. And so we can actually learn about dying without having to be dying ourselves. But the learning means that we hold ourselves to a standard of, while we're dying, to die as a healthy person. Healthy means that you're not fundamentally coming to your dying as some kind of adversary that means you harm. Rather, you could say, if you're dying as a wife or a husband or as a mother or a father or grandparent, that means your way of dying is an extension, is a declaration of everything you learned about parenting or grandparenting or being a companion. That's where it should appear, instead of suddenly everything suspended and, quote, nobody knows what to do. And this is where, you know, all the wisdom that hopefully has come to you during the course of your days, this is where it appears.
Let's take a call from Karen in Madison. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
I'm really glad you just said what you did. And my question is prompted by an earlier caller who was talking about, I believe his father is dying, and that they've already lost so much and they're grieving their loss.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that word flavors the way that we try to avoid even thinking about death.
Well, this is probably stronger than a flavor. It's more like a spell. To my mind, this is the most commonly used word as an adjective, as a kind of synonym for dying. But if you think about what the word lost means, it's not a synonym for dying at all or dead. Lost, it does not refer to what your dad did when he got sick enough, long enough, and stopped living. Lost means what you did to your father after he died, the same way as you lose your wallet or your car keys. It means what you did. And a strong statement would be, because someone dies, you're under no obligation to lose them. Lose is something else. And it's not part of the deal necessarily. Of course, I know, as everyone knows, you're not seeing the person again. You're not able to talk with them as you once did. But that's not what losing is. Losing is means gone forever, completely inaccessible, no presence, nothing enduring. Well, who says that that's the consequence of dying? I would go further and say the common way of dying in North America now, by refusing to do so, almost guarantees that loss will be the consequence of someone dying. And confounding multiple intergenerational losses mean that we have no lived experience of somehow being alongside those in our family line and our ancestral line who've lived before us. In other words, it's a kind of a recipe for a radical loneliness that masquerades as freedom.
So how can a changed perspective on death make our lives better or different?
Well, maybe better is not the right word, eh? Because when we hear better, we imagine like happier, I don't know, or easier. And that's not it. That's not what a grown-up person actually counts on from life, I hope. Could make it deeper. what dying does, endings of all kinds, particularly this big one we've been discussing, here's what I think it does. You know, we have a lot of good feelings about stuff we appreciate in our lives, but the ability to love them and to love other people, to love periods of our life and other things, they don't come from the from some kind of goofy guarantee that it will last as long as you want it to. No, I think the ability to love other people and other things, they come from a recognition that it's a time-limited proposition. When you glimpse the end of what you propose to hold dear, that begins your capacity to love it in a kind of radical and active and engaged fashion, where you're not contentious and you're not claiming that you should have some right to control all this. Something bigger. Your ability to love comes from glimpsing the end of what you propose to love. And any parent who's looked down into the crib of their sleeping kid has tasted what I'm saying right now. You know that's not going to last if you're willing to know it, and that's what enhances your ability to love this kid. Fundamentally, that's what it does. Well, say the same thing then about your life. You get a chance to see it as if it's not going to last, that it's not a rumor and it's not a threat. It's part of the story. And the real challenge is to love that part of the story, to recognize that's where your ability to love it all actually comes from. And it deepens very quickly when you begin to proceed in that fashion. And I guess that's what I'm after, is I'm talking about a deepening of things, which the dying time strangely endorses if you give it half a chance. Yeah. It's a kind of strong taskmaster. But grief, the first time we've used the word today, grief is you getting this, you see. It's not some devastation of your ability to understand. Grief actually deepens your understanding, and that's where your understanding for the rest of your life really lives, and we'll, capacity to grieve.
We will have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stephen Jenkinson is author of Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. He will be leading workshops on death and dying in Wisconsin next week. More information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network.